Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. Time Magazine recently came out with its list of influential climate leaders. Governor Josh Green was on that list. And today we hear from the second Hawaii Islander to rise to the top, a Native Hawaiian woman. And fireworks are on our minds as we close out 2025 and get ready to ring in the new year. It will mark the anniversary of the fatal fireworks explosion in an Oahu neighborhood. What new research tells us about migration patterns as whales return to Maui waters, and we look at a photo exhibit documenting the work underway removing marine debris from a Pacific National Marine Sanctuary. You are tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Time Magazine recently published a list of 100 influential climate leaders. Hawaii had not just one, but two people on that list. We talked to Governor Josh Green, who signed the green fee into law to use visitor dollars to offset the impact on the environment. And this morning, we hear from another name on that list, Aulani Wilhelm, who recently returned from the 30th United Nations Climate Change Conference. Wilhelm is the CEO of Neotero. She explains what the name means.
It means our earth in Esperanto, and of the language of peace that came out of World War I. It was really important, I think, when the founders created Neotero, that the name wasn't appropriated from any particular indigenous community, nor was it a colonizing language. And so they really turned to history and the creation of Esperanto as kind of inspiration for how we can all come together on a shared earth and have a common language.
You made Time Magazine's list of most influential leaders. What was that experience like for you, finding that out?
It was an incredible surprise and obviously quite an honor to be alongside such incredible leaders from around the world, from different sectors, the Pope, right? It was really an incredible honor to know that. And I think that, you know, what was more special was that it wasn't about any activity just in this year, even though they give it on an annual basis now for climate leadership to really make any traction in climate. It's really decadal work, and it isn't my work alone, and the honor isn't mine alone. It really reflects the many communities and people that I have had the privilege to engage with over the years, and also the work of the incredible organization that I'm fortunate to be able to lead now.
Our paths have crossed over the years. I mean, from the Department of Land and Natural Resources to NOAA, Conservation International, and now this organization. And it's just amazing just to see where you've put Hawaii on the map.
Well, I'd say Hawaii put herself on the map. And I feel fortunate that as kama'aina, as kanaka'oiwi, that I come from a place and I come from a culture that is able to be able to share the lessons and the understandings of that intimacy of people to our land and sea, and really help reflect that globally. I always tell people that when they ask, what are you doing internationally and how did you learn that? I will say, and I do say, that everything I learned helping to lead the charge to protect Papahanaumokuakea. You know, the kinds of skills, the kinds of engagement, the listening to elders. It was really a shoulder tap by a handful of elders in the Hawaiian community who said, hey, you had a chance to go to school. Come help us figure out how to do this to protect what is our ancestral realm, where we come from, and with any luck, where we'll return when we go back to Po or the source. And so, you know, I just feel incredibly fortunate, and it's really natural to be able to take the lessons from that experience and from our culture and share that globally, right? Hawaii has magic globally, and people pay attention because they want to understand and they want to taste again what they have heard in other cultures, you know, was once alive, and it draws them in. And interestingly, December 4th, the first protection or legal protection for what is now Papahanaumokuakea took place 25 years ago by President Clinton. So, you know, even in modern conservation times, that's a pretty amazing feat, right? To say that something has been a generation old and the efforts of community now, and that gets us closer and closer to that longevity that our ancestors understood, the view you have to have when you want to care for place.
Well, you just returned from Brazil for the COP 30 gathering. What was that like for you in your position as CEO, and what was the takeaway?
Yeah. COP30 this year was held in the Amazon rainforest, right, in a town called Belém. And people were like, why is it there? And it was a really important gathering because it was the second largest gathering at COP ever, but the largest gathering for indigenous peoples. And the Amazon region is where our organization actually has the most number of grants. So it was really important that our team showed up and that we were there in solidarity with the many indigenous peoples from dozens of countries who were there. So of the 56,000 people that were there, about 5,000 were indigenous. And that's pretty remarkable, right? In the past, in early COPs, I think my first COP, you'd have a really hard time finding indigenous peoples who were there. And if they weren't there, they weren't in on the conversations. They weren't in and had accredited badges for the big announcements, for the discussions, for the deliberations. And that was really different this year. 1,500 indigenous people, it's estimated, had accreditation. And that, for people who may not be involved in policy processes, that may not seem like a big deal, but it was a really marked change to be able to be at a table and in the discussion and witness to decision making versus outside looking in, hoping that people were paying attention.
Yeah, it's really growing power, right? Growing that base.
Yeah, it really is. And I think every time you go into a COP, you wonder, is this going to make a difference? And certainly, there's always more that can be done. And there were some things that, you know, maybe weren't as, we didn't achieve as much as we wanted to out of the COP, but there were some really good positive results. For example, it was the first time in UNFCCC. And so for those of you who that means nothing to, it's the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. That's a mouthful, so people say UNFCCC. It was the first time in that history of convenings that a decision by the COP, by the convention, explicitly recognized indigenous peoples' rights, including the right to free, prior, and informed consent. So that's under a different UN commitment called UNDRIP, the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. But to have it actually come into being and into play in decisions at this particular convention was really important. It also acknowledged people in voluntary isolation, that there are people who don't want to be part of the rest of conventional society and have not always been acknowledged as such or recognized. That is a right also in and of itself. And that was really important. And I also think important result of this COP was there was a strong set of maybe acknowledgments that really underscored the need for just transition pathways. People talk about just transition away from fossil fuels, and that's super important, as long as it doesn't infringe on the rights of indigenous peoples and indigenous lands. People who are 4 to 6%, depending on the measure you use, on the planet. And often people say, for the most number of people, we want to just transition. So we're going to do alternative fuels across the biggest migratory pathway in the Arctic, or something like that. And it really was important for this COP that a strong stance was made about the importance of that.
Yeah, more of a holistic view, really.
Well, culture. That justice needs to be for everyone.
Yes, yes. And then, gosh, I was just up at the East-West Center doing something on energy and Pacific Island nations, and that was fascinating for me to be able to see how far along some of our island...
Our cousins
were. They're ahead of us or behind us. And I imagine in your position now, you really get to see more of that.
There's so much opportunity for Hawaii, and I'm really proud that for a few administrations now already, there's been consistent support, right, to try to make sure that we do a transition away from fossil fuels and that we make commitments. We have a long way to go, but we can also differentiate by island, right? And you've seen some incredible progress being made in counties here on Kauai, on Hawaii Island. And so those are all super encouraging. And there's a lot of commitments that are being made here. It's more complicated on Oahu, but there are important strides being made. And by being able to do what you're saying, you know, connect with other island cousins and seeing what's happening in islands around the world, that helps us be able to see things that maybe in our own context we're unable to see, and vice versa, right? So we can't really underscore that importance of Hawaii really remembering that we are in a global community and that we can't stick to just our own context or even the context of the U.S.
Well, and the U.S. was not there at COP30. I don't know, I've been seeing lots of headlines about that, but what was your impression about that?
Well, I had a role before in a previous administration in policymaking, and it's important to have the United States be at these meetings, at these gatherings, in these conversations. So the absence was quite obvious and quite felt. There were some people who, given the stated policies of this administration, were maybe a little bit relieved that those influences weren't there. At the same time, it's a pretty sad miss for those of us who are within the United States and really want to have a conduit to be in these international conversations as a nation.
And then what do you think is going to be the biggest challenge for you in your new role?
People don't understand who Indigenous peoples are in many places around the world. And it's coming at a time where we're asking people to care about so many things, right? There's so many things for people to worry about that it's often difficult for people to understand why engage with Indigenous people. The thing about climate is that climate affects all of us, right? And it affects everyone differentially, right? It still has harder impacts on people who have less resources. But at the same time, it's something that we all have to work to address. And the little known fact about Indigenous people is that roughly 4-6% of the planet, of the population, are Indigenous. And yet that small percentage is protecting the majority of the best of what's left on the planet. Easily 40, some people say up to 60% of the best of what's left is in the hands of Indigenous peoples. It's being continuously for generations protected. That's not something that we're saying we need to return to. That's happening now. The success of Indigenous people in still protecting what the rest of humanity is benefiting from is intact. And what we need to be doing is investing in that more. By not doing that, and by ignoring that that's the only time-tested way to keep ecosystems intact, right? Conservation's great and it's important, but it evolved out of damage to the ecosystems, out of a need for a restoration. Indigenous guardianship is the time-tested, proven way to keep nature intact, right? And so because nature is not external for Indigenous people, we're part of nature, right? So there's not this kind of false separation, which is why Indigenous people stay in place as much as you can. So by not investing in Indigenous peoples, we're missing a huge opportunity, and actually it's really bad climate policy. So good climate policy has to engage and invest in Indigenous peoples.
Well, I like that notion, protectors.
It is.
All right. Thank you so much for coming by.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. Good to see you.
And that was Aulani Wilhelm, CEO of the organization Neotero. She was one of two people from Hawaii on Time Magazine's list of influential climate leaders.
Support for HPR comes from Treehouse, with gifts for photographers, including disposable cameras, Polaroids, camera bags, and photo books, at Salt Kaka'ako or treehouse-shop.com. Support for HPR comes from Aloha Air Cargo, connecting Hawaii by providing inter-island shipping, with services including Aloha Next Flight Out, Aloha Standard Overnight, and Aloha Economy. AlohaAirCargo.com.
This morning, Honolulu Civil Beat's lead story is one about fireworks. As we get ready to welcome the new year, here to talk with us today is Investigations Editor John Hill. Good morning, John.
Hi, Catherine.
You know, thanks for doing this. I heard some illegal fireworks go off in my neighborhood recently, and, you know, it sets me on edge just because of that terrible tragedy we had a year ago, you know, with the explosion in an Oahu neighborhood that killed all those people. It was just terrible.
It was. And, you know, the authorities, the Department of Law Enforcement and others say they're really stepping up enforcement this year, so we'll see if it's has a noticeable effect on what happens on New Year's Eve.
Well, share with our listeners what you found in your investigation.
Well, we had earlier in March published a story about an illegal shipment of fireworks to Honolulu Harbor worth $2.7 million, and we traced it to some people in Illinois. And it turns out those people also run these retail outlets where they legally sell firecrackers on Oahu and the other islands. And it turns out that despite the connections we showed between them and this illegal shipment, that they were granted permits to continue running these retail businesses on the island. Well, so far on Oahu and on Maui, and they have an application pending on Kauai.
And then these retail shops, I mean, they sell what? The novelties, right? Fireworks, the firecrackers and poppers, those kinds of things?
Yeah, I mean, it varies from island to island. On Oahu, it's only firecrackers. On, I believe on some of the other islands, you can get some other things. But what they do not sell are aerial fireworks, the kind that light up the sky on we all see on New Year's Eve, that look like kind of display fireworks that shoot up into the air. Those are not allowed in Hawaii.
And then your probe looked at the connection of between that one shipment, that illegal shipment, and then these, you know, permitted businesses. But what does the Department of Law Enforcement say about, you know, why they gave them permits again?
Well, it was actually it was the local fire departments, like the Honolulu Fire Department, that issued the permits. But they said they did it in consultation with the Department of Law Enforcement. And because they haven't taken any legal action, there hasn't been a conviction or even an indictment against this company, they feel that they don't have legal grounds to deny them permits. Now, the Department of Law Enforcement keeps it pretty close to the vest about who they're investigating, and they say they have some indictments coming down sometime soon against some fireworks violators. They wouldn't say if these folks were among them because they don't want to jeopardize their investigations. And so they really won't say very much about who they're investigating until an indictment comes down. So we'll see if these folks are among them, but the signs don't indicate that they are.
Well, what was that like for you when you were, you know, doing the digging and, you know, trying to figure out who was behind these shipments?
Well, I mean, it was a pretty tangled web, and we followed all these different leads and finally kind of put it all together that, oh, eureka, the people who brought in this illegal shipment are the same people who for 25 years have been running these retail outlets in the islands. It was kind of strange, though, Catherine, to tell you the truth, that we were able to do this, and we were kind of asking ourselves, wait a second, why didn't law enforcement do this, you know, because obviously we don't have the powers that they do to pull up records and to, I mean, we can pull up some records, but they have access to more records than we do. And why didn't anybody pursue this in 2022? And we've never really gotten an answer to that.
Well, it'd be interesting to see, you know, what happens when the other shoe drops, right? When they finish their investigations and see if anything comes up with it.
Yeah, we'll see if anything ever comes of this group or whether just year after year they keep giving them permits to sell firecrackers. That will be interesting to see.
All right, we'll have to stay tuned. But thank you so much, John.
Thank you, Catherine.
We've been hearing from Honolulu Civil Beat Investigations Editor John Hill. Look for his story at civilbeat.org. You know, when the first humpback whales returned to Lahaina after the 2023 wildfires, many saw the milestone as an early sign of healing and resilience. Now, a group studying those migratory whales say the animals' behavior has changed since the fires. The whales have returned with their keiki closer to the shoreline, and researchers say it's important to keep the whales in mind as commercial boat operations return to Lahaina Harbor next week. Rachel Cartwright is the lead researcher with the Keiki Kohola Project. Cartwright spoke with The Conversation's Maddie Bender about the whales of Lahaina and all they've overcome, from whaling to a marine heat wave and now the devastating fires.
Well, I think when we started our work, we were working with this resurging population that were coming out of the impacts of whaling days. And so what we were looking for is how exciting it was to see these little healthy calves doing so well, and were they surviving, and were they going to make it to Alaska over that first natal migration. In terms of our research, we really looked at how the behavior changed over time, because you do see this huge variation in calf behavior. Although the initial work was very much about those developmental stages, It turns out it's their youngest calves that are the most active. And then as they get a little older is when they start to rest and grow really fast as well and stay with mom. And that's a really pre-migratory stage. Probably the one of the more interesting studies that we did was when I was actually working as faculty at Cal State Channel Islands over there in California and continued the research there with students and undergraduates getting involved. And one of the things we looked at there is quite an extensive project to look at the physiological explanation of why those calves breach. Because if you've watched calves, you'll see them breaching and breaching and breaching. And so one of the first kind of obsessions I had was about that. And I had some ideas when I was doing my PhD, but I couldn't quite get there. And so once I got to the university and I had the opportunity to work in the labs, we did a study of the muscle tissue. There is a substance in the muscle called myoglobin. And myoglobin is to muscles what hemoglobin is to blood. It's an oxygen carrier. And we were able to show that when the calves are first born, they have almost no myoglobin in their muscles. Their muscles tissue looks like chicken breast. It looks like really light white in color. And over the course of them exercising, by working with a biochemist that really studies processes at the cellular level, we put together the whole process whereby when the calves are exercising, they are producing just the right type of calcium in the muscles. And that triggers the production of myoglobin. So they're actually working out when they're breaching like that. But the purpose of it is to build their breath hold capacity. So when the calves are first born, they have very limited breath hold capacity. And this is just one of those really interesting overlaps between ecology and physiology, where we can see the behavior and then you understand it's a really crucial part of their physiology. So in recent years, we have been looking at the impact of climate change on calving rates. And what we found in a paper we published in 2019 was, you know, as much as we were concerned about the welfare of those calves, it's really the energetic cost for the mom that is so crucial in all this. And that's really interesting work that's now been done by the students and the PhD students and postdocs over there at the Marine Mammal Research Group in Honolulu. What we really saw in the heat wave was kind of like a mini glimpse into the ravages that could come with climate change. Because in the heat wave, we had this 2-year period of intense warming in the North Pacific that moved right into their feeding grounds. And in those warm waters, the phytoplankton that are really nutritious disappeared. And so the base of the food chain was altered. And there just wasn't enough high quality food for the whales for a couple of years. And we saw a reduction in the overall number of calves from peak to trough was over 90%. So that was the reduction in the numbers of mothers giving birth to calves. The 2-year comparisons were about 70% drop. And so we've come to understand, I think, a lot better how whales are going to respond in periods of poor nutrition. And that's been seen in lots of populations now. The reproductive rate drops, the number of calves produced drops quite dramatically. So it's not that they have calves and they don't survive. It's that those, their moms, literally their body triggers them to take a pause on reproduction. So I think it's quite interesting over the period that we've been doing this work, how, you know, we were really functioning on healthy calves and happy calves. And, you know, we've really had to switch. And I think as biologists, we all have to really focus on what the future holds for our whale populations now.
I think that's an important point, and it speaks to the research that you do, how it is driven by basic science, but it also has to adapt. And as you observe populations going through stress, as you see events happening in and around their habitat, and the Lahaina wildfire is a great example of that. You couldn't have predicted that that was going to happen, but if you had been set in your 10-year research plan, you wouldn't have necessarily had the time or resources to pivot and study what was happening to the whales. So tell us a bit about what questions you've been looking at and preliminarily what kinds of answers you might have.
So as you say, you know, responding to what's happening around you, I think is really important in science that we pivot and we do address the emerging issues. And of course, the Lahaina wildfire altered lives for so many of us. And looking at the natural resources as well is became the second concern in some ways. But since then, we've seen this real resurgence, such that the work we did in the last couple of weeks, the last season, was supported by a grant we got from Maui Green Grants. So that's the County of Maui funding those grants to really look and see how natural resources like the whales have been impacted. And lucky for us, we were able to pivot because one of the things we've been doing is long-term surveys. You know, they're not the most exciting things to do on the boat. You go up and down a transit line at a very, very regular pace, and you can keep a track of habitat use and where the whales are, and also the numbers that we have and the reproductive rates, the number of calves you see and things like that. So we had a background set of data that we could use. We didn't get out immediately following the fires in 24. It was logistics of it didn't line up for us. But in 25, this year, we got out. And so we ran our transect surveys up and down. And those allow us to compare where the whales are now to where they have been in the past in these exact identical surveys. So it was quite interesting what we found out because, you know, every cloud has a little tiny silver lining. And what we saw is the whales, the moms and calves specifically, have moved a little closer to shore and they have moved into shallower waters. Now, if you look at the real first research done on mother and calf dynamics in Hawaii waters was done by a lady called Debbie Ferrari, Mark Ferrari. People may remember those if they're as old as us. They actually published that mothers and calves, 80% of mothers and calves were in half a mile of the shoreline. Well, when we came along and looked at that, we're like, no. And our studies showed, you know, 2 to 4 miles off was where there's this real mom and calf alley that just runs right up and down off the shoreline of Lahaina. Well, it may be that, you know, the reduction in the amount of traffic has allowed the mothers and calves to maybe move back into some of those areas a little bit more, because we were really finding them in 40, 50 feet of water, and they were resting there and really calm. So we're still working on the analysis, and we're going to do another year of data, and we are opening the harbor, but it's a soft opening. So we'll keep a track of the level of vessel traffic, but it does seem that, you know, they have moved a little further in and they are a little closer to shore, and that might be historically where they like to be. So we might get some really interesting science out of this. We can also then apply that to, as we do have the soft opening of Lahaina Harbor, we can take into consideration and we can suggest to people what we've seen and just let people know what we've seen. And then maybe with harbors, to really work out what's the best way as we reopen to take into consideration the whales that support so much of our economy and so much of our livelihood. You know, maybe we can really make sure that the environment is still as good for them.
You're right that, I mean, influencing how we go about reopening the harbor could be directly tied to the findings of this work. But also, I can imagine even knock-on effects. If you've ever been driving in West Maui and seen those scenic outlooks, people will be gathered there. If they're lucky enough during whale season, you'll see a bunch of breaches, and you might even see more now that the whales are closer to shore. So it's all things to take into consideration.
Yeah, and I think that there's also a feeling, you know, when you see that whale breach, whether you're a local or a visitor that's been coming here for 20 years, it's still a very special moment. You remember it, you go home, you talk about it, it adds to the quality of life. And we're so lucky to live in a place where we can see that. So I think the chance to, you know, there is a little opening here to fully understand where the whales might prefer to be, especially those moms and calves, and just take that into consideration in how we operate.
That was Rachel Cartwright of the Keiki Kohola Project, which used to operate out of Lahaina Harbor prior to the fires. She spoke with HPR's Maddie Bender. Cartwright will give a free webinar about her preliminary findings on the whales of West Maui tomorrow at 5:30 p.m. And we will have more information on our website after the show.
Support for HPR comes from the Hawaii Department of Transportation, wishing all a safe holiday season by planning to have a designated driver for parties and events. HIDOT.hawaii.gov. Mosby Divers Jewelry, offering made-in-Hawaii jewelry since 1959. Collections in stores across the islands and online at mauidivers.com.
You know, we kicked the week off highlighting the Papahanao Makuakea Marine Debris Project and an upcoming marine debris hackathon. Today, we turn the light on a photography exhibit that opened this month. It's a fundraiser to help with the work underway to clear the marine debris found in the remote marine preserve. Andy Sullivan Haskins is the drone pilot whose work as an expedition photographer is part of an art exhibit at Kalapawai Cafe in Kailua here on Oahu. He explains how the art show fundraiser works.
A very generous donor will match up to $50,000 of donations that are given. Kalapawai Cafe and Deli has been kind enough to offer us this space throughout December to highlight some of our work. There's also going to be some other really awesome artists like Patrick Ching and Karen Lobo-Fried. So basically, you know, this is kind of deal where it's a fundraising art showcase. You come in, have some food, grab a sandwich, have dinner, and we're going to be showcasing the artwork up all around the cafe. My work particularly focuses on ocean conservation, marine conservation issues, wildlife conservation, and I've been lucky enough to follow around the Papahanao Makuakea Marine Debris Project for the last 4 years, documenting all of the blood, sweat, and tears that goes into this work. You know, my goal is to give a voice to the wildlife, to the coral, to the place that not a lot of people get to see, and also highlight the people that are doing this effort, because it really is a tremendous amount of commitment and effort that goes into it. You really see the pure soul of a person that's going out and swimming for miles and miles a day, hours a day, diving up and down in the hot sun, windy, cold conditions, whatever it might be, swimming around with large wildlife. It's a really, really special opportunity to go out there and document that.
Well, some people think, oh, Papahanao Makuakea, you guys are so lucky you get to go out in this pristine area, but I imagine some of those areas are not so pristine.
Yeah, exactly. That's a big reason why we started doing this. Previously, I worked as a biologist for the state of Hawaii on one of these remote atolls and spent years out there witnessing how much of an effect the marine debris was having on the wildlife in the different colonies, the monk seals, the honu. And that's actually how I met Kevin and James, who started the Papahanao Makuakea Marine Debris Project. They were kind of like my heroes. They'd come out and clean up this debris. And I think that is a little bit of a misunderstanding, is the islands are so remote and really kind of off limits because they're protected. You have this idea that it's just a beautiful, pristine ecosystem. And while that's partially true, the amount of debris that comes in is staggering. Where we'll go in and we'll clean up an entire island's shoreline. And you can come back a couple days later and items have already started to arrive and accumulate. It's really hard to explain how much debris there is that's taking up this area. And all the young wildlife is drawn to that. It's an attractive nuisance. So they see a large net come up. A young seal will see that as protection, lay next to it, and then runs the risk of getting entangled in that. And that's what we see all the time. You know, for every turtle that we save, we also find a lot of bones. We find dead birds, a lot of them young. And that's really what's at stake and why we're out there doing that.
So the photos will be, what, a combination of drone pictures and underwater, in the water kind of a deal?
Yeah, it's a little bit of everything. I'm lucky enough to also be able to do the job. So while we fly the drone, like scientifically, also we have the opportunity to take some beautiful highlight photos. And I always try to incorporate something in there where it might be a beautiful drone shot, but there's also some imagery of us working in the background. The most important thing to me is to really highlight that, highlight what's happening out there, the work that's being done, and showcase a little bit of the area. But it's hard to show just a beautiful picture of a beach without telling the rest of the story.
And are we talking color photos, black and white?
Yeah, this is going to be all color, some large format prints. We have drone shots, underwater, split shots, a lot of terrestrial stuff, some wildlife, landscape, a little bit of a mixed bag. And then some of the other featured artists are just exceptional that do a lot of like beautiful wildlife and landscape shots. some of them that you've probably seen. You know, Karen's an amazing block printer, and Patrick Ching has been around forever doing amazing work. And then there's another about five artists that will also be featured, and it's all ocean-themed, and it's all a fundraising showcase. So that's the important thing is, you know, we don't want people just coming in to just filter through the restaurant. We want to also support the local businesses at Kalapawai Cafe and Deli, have people come in, get a meal, check out the work, and also hopefully be inspired to follow through with that donation match challenge and multiply the amount of money that you're going to donate. So if you give $50, it'll be matched, and your donation instantly becomes $100.
And then the exhibit of your photos that you will show, any favorites?
Yeah, I get that question a lot, and it's really hard. I don't have a favorite picture. I usually lean towards imagery, and most of them are showcased from this year, that has a little bit of everything. That really, I feel like, is the most impactful way to portray what's happening. It's the work that's being done. It looks hard. It looks beautiful. It also kind of invokes a feeling of, like, is this really what's happening out there? This is a large-scale marine debris cleanup by highly specialized and trained individuals. So they're driving boats. They're diving down to pretty reasonably deep depths. So my favorite pictures are something that encapsulates everything, a little bit of the work, a little bit of the place, and a little bit of that power to kind of evoke the feeling of emotion and wanting to understand more about the situation out there.
Is there anything that you don't like about what you do when you're out there documenting this stuff?
There really isn't anything I don't like about the missions or being out there. It's really impactful, actionable work. And I find that that's really the strongest point of doing this, is you're really taking action. I always say I wish we could be out there longer. When we have to leave is usually the most disappointing day. I have a little bit of a rush of feeling of accomplishment, but we always leave some on the table. We can only fill up the ship so much, and we could stay out there for months continuing to clean a lot of these areas. Now, although it's been less and less every year, it's still coming. And the work still has to be done. So that would probably be the biggest regretful thing, is that we have to leave. But as far as the work, I love it. Yeah.
Just so you know, there's more work to be done.
Yeah, exactly. And it's, you know, it's not about us. It's just that you're actually putting your hands and your brain in motion to help and take action and actually do it. When you actually find a honu that's been stuck in a net for a few days, and you can tell there's, you know, algal growth, maybe it's starting to really like run out of steam, and you can disentangle it, you can free it, you can remove a big net from a coral ecosystem and know that you're protecting other wildlife that will come. Because if we're only out there for, say, 80 to 90 days a year, the rest of the year, what's happening? Then our holiday match challenge will run through December. Really encourage people to stop by. If not, check out our website, follow us along on social media. We'd love to share the kind of work we're doing, because it is in such a remote place. We're not front line for the local community to just see us in action.
We were hearing from Andy Sullivan Haskins, whose work as a photographer on the Papahanaumokuakea expedition is being exhibited this month at Kalapawai Cafe in Kailua. Under the banner Sea of Life, the fundraiser highlights the conservation work underway in the Pacific Marine National Monument through artwork and photos. There will be an artist reception at the cafe this Sunday, December 13th. Look for links on our website later today. And that's a wrap for us. Tomorrow, we plan to catch up with waterman Mark Cunningham. He was recently inducted into the Swimmers Hall of Fame and shares his latest passion with us, marine debris art. I'm Catherine Cruz.